Our final paper is by Anna Hrant Soralic at the Institute Barcelona de Estudios Regionales. And the title is Taking Values at the EU, Talking Values at the EU, sorry, Talking Benefits and Risks at Home, The Elite's Public Gap Over EU Enlargement.
Anna. Thank you. In fact, the title changed a bit, and now you'll see. But yeah, while we upload this, let me begin by thanking Vanu and Vilgin and the KFG for such a nice conference and for giving me the opportunity to present this paper in such a big group of experts on Turkey, EU enlargement, but also on public political communication, public sphere, just beginning by this table. So the paper I am presenting is part of, is related to the work I did for my PhD, which in which I compared different enlargement rounds in several aspects. And one of those aspects was public opinion and communication, political communication about EU enlargement. And well, this is the paper I am presenting today. To stick to the 15 minutes, I will present very briefly these 4 points and skip a bit the details, but yeah, I hope you can follow the whole thing. Well, I'll begin by explaining a bit the empirical puzzle where I start from. Here in this graph, you can see the evolution of the public opinion on enlargement since the first accession, the first Great Britain's accession. And what is obvious is that the number, the percentage of opponents has been increasingly quite exponentially all over time. It was 10% against Great Britain, about 20% in the case of the southern enlargement, 30% in the case of the eastern enlargement, and 40-50% with the accession of Turkey or incoming enlargement. But despite that, the EU has grown from 6 to 27, and it plans to, or is committed, in fact, to integrate at least 8 more members. So in that sense, we could argue that there is some elites public gap going on there. But if we look at specific member states, we see that this gap is even more clear, because here you have on the x-axis the support to Eastern enlargement, support to Turkey's accession. We can see that member states that have been traditional enlargement drivers, the governments, I mean, are those where the public opinion is, in fact, most against enlargement. And here, for example, the case of Germany is marked in red because it's one of those cases, but not the only one. We also find the UK, a traditional enlargement driver, but very skeptical public opinion, but also the reverse case. For example, we see the cohesion countries like Spain, Portugal, being very in favor of Eastern enlargement, while their governments were traditionally conceived or perceived as brakemen. So I think this gap has been overlooked in the literature on EU enlargement, which has been focused on analyzing, well, the results of the interaction among governments. And of course, there is this literature about public opinion, which has evermore dealt with the question of how to explain public opinion, which has been basically altered these two variables, or more instrumental variables to explain that. So the perception, the expectations of costs and benefits from people, the level of interaction with the candidate country, but also identity-based variables, the fears by people of the impact of enlargement for their in-group culture, perceived cultural differences, prejudices. But here is when the theoretical puzzle comes in. And if we look at the data, disregarding these factors, we see that a public opinion evolves not only across enlargements, but also in the same country across the same enlargement round. So this plays down the relevance of relatively invariable factors, such as levels of migration or these prejudices, which are quite stable over time. So this, what points to is to the importance of the process of opinion formation. And not only, well, I claim that not only through the press, but also by other privileged opinion makers, which are political elites. So I claim that we have to look at that and how it has played that well. How I argue that political communication might influence public attitudes. Here, there are very important works on how public opinion or public political communication influences on public opinion, mostly focus on party political party cues and polarization. And here, the work by Professor Marx is an example of. But here, I propose to focus on a different question, which I think it has been overlooked, and which is the match between the coordinative discourse and the communicative discourse, or what is the same, the coherence between the political elite justification of policy decisions in the context of EU institutions. So what are the justifications for enlargement in the context of decision making, and the communicative discourse, which is what political elites explain directly to their citizens. How do they justify these decisions taken at EU level? And there has been a lot of, there are some authors that claim that the EU is specifically very prone to this mismatch, because a lot of effort is concentrated on the coordinative discourse because of the composite nature of the EU, while the communicative discourse is very thin and very diffuse. And here I claim that in areas where the public support cannot be taken for granted, the political elites have a big incentive to convey the messages a bit differently in order to target or to present more tailor-made arguments that can better fit or appeal in their audiences. So when there is this probability that that public support won't be high, there is this chance of opening a gap. And however rational this strategy may seem, the hypothesis I put forward is that the bigger this mismatch, the more negative the impact of political communication on public attitudes will be. And here, sorry to focus that much on the analytical part, but to follow the conclusions, just let me explain why I think there are reasons to sustain this hypothesis. And firstly, I think that when the gap is big, there is the risk that two of the criteria, which, for example, in the deliberative studies are considered as very important for the persuasiveness of a discourse, which are consistency and plausibility, will probably be affected. Because we have talked about this in the previous session. It is nowadays very difficult to separate discourse at intram and one at extram. So probably the change of discourse, even if it's to argue in the same direction, will probably be noticed somehow by citizens. But also the second point is that when elites want to face a skeptical audience, they are probably going to focus on the fears or the alleged fears by citizens. So and this, as securitization studies argue, sometimes if it's not carefully managed, these risks reifying those fears instead of banishing them. And thirdly, I also argue that when facing negative public opinions, it is also probable that elites will resort to negative modes of social influence, like emotionalization, propaganda, the use of threats, which, as social identity theories have posed it is normally do not work in the context of elites, mass opinion, because the influencer has generally no means of either punishment or reward by elites. And yeah, I'm going to summarize the result, the analysis. What I did in the paper is first very briefly summarizing what the EU coordinative discourse and what are the main justifications. The main justifications for EU enlargement present in the EU institutions, and here what the two discourses which I found very very relevant across time are: on the one hand, the first justification is that the EU enlarges because it has responsibility for the spread of peace, stability, and democracy in Europe. That's a very common and very established argument. And the second justification is that enlargement helps is a means to increase political and economic power of Europe. And this has been quite stable across time. Of course, this should not be conflated with the motives. These are the justifications for. The motives can be very varied, but this is the only thing I have found that consistently makes collective sense of what we are doing with this enlargement. And then for the analysis of the communicative discourse, I took Germany, as I said, and here I've analyzed all the party manifestos since 1979, the federal and the European. Interviews from that German politicians give to the German press, parliamentary debates in Germany. And here, just to summarize the debates or the communication about the southern enlargement, the discursive gap, as we could call it, was really, really very low. The main argument that was used was solidarity, responsibility for democracy in those countries, very consistently. And here, what we see is a very positive evolution of the German public opinion that increased 20 points throughout the accession process. But also, when I mean here qualitative indicators, also indicate resonance. What do I mean for that is that at the same time that this support increased 20 points, also increased about 15 points the number of respondents who thought that enlargement would harm Germany. So this means that at least that these two trends in parallel indicate that at least the solidarity argument has some kind of was bought somehow. In the Eastern enlargement, we still find these arguments of responsibility and basically. But I have some figures in the paper that show that the main justification of why are we enlarging towards the Central and Eastern European countries was material benefits for incumbent member states. So it was argued that in positive terms, so it will bring more jobs, more benefits to our economy and all that. But also it was insisted a lot about the costs of non-enlargement, that non-enlargement would be much worse because of the risks of destabilization, the risk of more migration. And also the communication was very much focused on reassuring citizens that all those fears they had would not materialize, because German elites would protect citizens from occurring, that they would introduce long transition periods and budgetary cuts and all that. And here I have in the paper some evidence that even in some very restricted contexts, so for example, in the Commission of EU Affairs, in a meeting with experts, all experts and politicians were arguing, well, we know that there's not going to be any big impact in terms of migration, and that the impact will be, in fact, positive. But I have some quotation that say, well, we are here discussing that because people has fears and we have to tackle them. So this is also very indicative. So here, the discursive gap was quite medium because the two strands of discourse were quite conducted in parallel. And here the evolution was very stable, but still very, very negative, around 40%, 40% against, 40% in favor. And the qualitative questions put in the Eurobarometers do not show any resonance of these arguments. And then with the accession of Turkey, the communicative gap is really very big. Even from the pro-enlargement governments, the parties, the accession was justified in terms of prevent security risks such as terrorism. And here, just to read some example, a quotation by by Fischer. Joschka Fischer, former Foreign Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and he said, the conflict with communism was the actual reason why Turkey was included in NATO and why, since 1963, the promise of accession to a European Economic Community was made. The Islamic terrorism does not have panzer armies available, but it targets our lifestyle and our open societies. Then I don't understand why the argument of our security, which counted so much during the Cold War, is now frivolously dismissed. And here, this is one of those I like, because if he even acknowledges that this is not working. But in the parliament, there are really very clear sentences that we are enlarging because we need to fight against terrorism. And for example, from the SPD political party 2005 manifesto, the logic was that who was questioning that was insecuritizing Europe and was bringing insecurity to citizens. So using these negative modes of social influence, naming and shaming the responsible citizens who dared questioning important. So just to finish here, and we see a very negative evolution from 2000 to 2006 of the German public opinion. It increased the number of opponents from 56 to 78. And also the qualitative indicators also say that the Germans were among the less of those who answered that Turkey's accession would bring peace. So, just to very conclude, here maybe just to talk about the theoretical implications of the paper is about this, what I call this paradox of strategic communication, because even if it's for arguing something which is coherent in decision with the EU decision, it can turn that these changes, this gap can turn, I think, counterproductive. But normatively, the paper carries the implication that the gap is not good and should be avoided. But this is why I was asking in the previous panel to Ulrich, that is very difficult to judge in which way it should be closed. It should be about Europeanizing the communication at home, or domestication or nationalizing debates at the EU. And there is, I have no answer, and this is not the place. But I think that when we face those gaps, we should just think about what is going to happen, because it's not really tenable. That's why. But thank you.
Thank you very much, Anna.